And now I'd like to welcome Johnny up for the message.
Good morning, Believers Fellowship and whoever's listening. Hey, my name is Johnny Pearson, and I am on staff here as part of BFSM, Believers Fellowship Student Ministries, one of the youth pastors. And man, it has been a great ride here just to see what God's doing through, even in the midst of COVID. So wherever you are, thank you for supporting us, and thank you for stepping out in faith and being that example, that Christ-like example that Sean even mentioned and encouraged us to be this morning. Well, here's the deal. My experience as a youth pastor has led me to see a lot of ups and downs in the lives of not just families, but also a lot of teenagers. And not just teenagers, but even now former students who are in their 20s and 30s, and as parents and families as well. And as a youth pastor, I get a unique glimpse into big spiritual moments, similar to what Stephanie Souter does with Crew, where she gets to see these mountaintop experiences with these students on college campuses. I also get a chance to see those mountaintop experiences on mission trips or at camps or retreats. And it's pretty amazing and epic to be able to step into the lives of someone who wants to commit to Jesus, who wants to pursue Jesus with all of their heart. It's amazing. And it's really what fuels and what excites me most about being in student ministries. And I would say the same thing for my team. Jen is passionate. She became a Christian. Jen Bonham, our student ministries coordinator, she became a Christian in college and now has this desire and heart because that mountaintop experience was so powerful for her. She wants to make sure that every young person knows about Jesus. Or John Lucas, who has been here a couple years now. He celebrated October 1st, his two-year anniversary with us. Super excited to have John Lucas here as part of our student ministry staff. And he talks about his mountaintop experience being a mentorship that he had an older guy build into him and walk with him. And how cool that is to now be a part of middle school students' lives and walk with them and share those mountaintop experiences. The hard part about it, though, is after these students recommit their lives or say, yeah, I want to put aside my addiction, put aside my shame, and pursue Jesus fully, no longer do we get literally off the mountain from our winter retreat when they feel bombarded with spiritual attacks. They feel guilt and shame that they can't do this, that everyone they know will think they're a hypocrite. And they have the season of the valley of unbelief and doubt. Almost this season of, man, I knew it was too good to be true. When I was up on the mountain, there were no distractions. All my heart was fully engaged to Jesus. But now that I'm back in real life, that's not what my relationship with God looks like. But is that the way it has to be? Is that what we have to lean on, those spiritual mountaintop experiences, only to come down to the valley and come to reality? Or is it possible to sustain a relationship with Jesus? Is it possible to walk faithfully for years and years and years until we meet him again in heaven? This is kind of the spiritual arc that we see in our narrative this morning in Mark chapter 9, where this experience of mountaintop spiritual experiences and valley lows is kind of similar to what we're going to see. So let's go ahead and dig in. We've got a lot to cover. There's probably a couple sermons in here, but we're going to do our best. We're going to be in Mark chapter 9, verses 2 through 29 today. So if you have your Bibles, open them up, or you can we'll put it on the screen for you if you're not able to do that. So here we go. Mark chapter 9, verse 2. It says, after 6 days... Let's pause there. After 6 days, we're just kind of just fill in the blank. So what's going on now? It's important to put it in context. So let me kind of recap a little bit about what Matt talked about last week. And here's what I love about recaps. It kind of catches us up to what is going on. And no one does recaps better than Hollywood. You know, think of the best characters. Some of my favorite characters are Luis from Ant-Man. Do you remember him? He's the guy that's like always catching us up to what's going on. And he's like, and then there was this guy, I met so-and-so in prison. And I was like, hey. And there's like lip sync or Yeah, lip syncing going on, and it's really funny. Another favorite recap of mine is from Frozen 2, where Olaf, he recaps all of Frozen 1 in like 30 seconds, and it's very impressive, and it's like very funny. It's one of my favorite parts of the movie. So here's a little movie recap for you based on what happened 6 days ago, because after 6 days, it's kind of a significant phrase. So here's what happened. Jesus is doing some pretty amazing things, and he has gathered quite a following to himself. What kind of amazing things? Well, he's feeding 5,000 people with just a few loaves. He's recovering sight for blind people that have never seen before. And word starts to get around that this Jesus guy is the guy to follow. He's the one they want to be around. So Jesus wants to know what the word on the street is. He's like, hey, what are the people saying about me? And he asks his inner circle, he asks his boys, his disciples, and everybody's like, well, some people say you're like Elijah, some people say you're like John the Baptist, some people even say you're just another prophet. And then he turns it on them and he says, what do you say about me? And then this week at Peter's really big confession of like, no, Jesus, you're the Christ. You are the anointed one. You're the one that's going to come and restore Israel. And you're gonna take the tyranny of Rome out, and we're gonna rise with you, Jesus. And Jesus is like, mostly true, but let's keep that on the down low, right? Jesus is always asking people to keep it on the DL. We'll get to that later. So after that, Jesus goes on this teaching and the idea that he actually, yes, is the Messiah, but he must suffer, he must be rejected, and he must die, and he must rise again. All that his disciples hear is the suffer, reject, and die part, not necessarily the rise again. And so they're kind of like, whoa, what is he talking about? And Jesus is teaching this now to all of the crowd. And Peter actually pulls Jesus aside and says, hey, Jesus, we don't have to go this route, okay? You're talking about suffering and rejection. That's not what the crowd wants to hear. They want more miracles. They need more bread. Let's do that, okay? Chop, chop. And Jesus says, he's probably having this flashback to the moment, like Peter's saying, hey, you can rule right now. You don't have to suffer and die and be rejected. You could probably do your thing now we can create an army if you wanted. And Jesus is flashed back to the desert where he's being tempted by Satan, where he says, hey, here's the shortcut. You want to rule, you can rule now. Just bow down to me. And Jesus knows that no shortcut will ever take place. So he comes back to reality, sees Peter acting as Satan, and he actually calls Peter Satan. He says, get behind me, Satan. And then he goes on to say, if you want to follow me, you need to deny yourself, pick up your cross daily, and let's go. That's what happened a week ago. That's what happened 6 days ago in our story. So now we have these disciples who are following Jesus and thinking, okay, Jesus is pretty awesome. We've seen that. He speaks with authority. He has the power to forgive sins. He has the power to raise people from the dead. We want to follow him, but now it looks different than what we thought. So what are we going to do with that? You can imagine the awkward conversations that take place, or like when they're all walking along and kind of like the eye contact, look away. Like, what are we doing now? Like, are we suffering now? Are we going to be put to death with him? Like, what are we going to do? So 6 days later is where we get our story. And now you're caught up. So let's dig in. All right, so Mark chapter 9, verse 2. It says, after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. And there he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. This is a unique story. And I want to kind of tell you a little bit about what I understand the transfiguration to be, and then I'll maybe give you a couple reasons why Jesus chose to be transfigured in front of these boys, these followers. First of all, many of you might know, I'm getting my master's degree online, and for the record, I was doing online school before it was cool. Okay, so I'm getting my master's degree online, and one of the degree requirements is to study a language, and you can either study Hebrew or Greek, and I heard that Hebrew is a little more harder. Not only that, because you have to read right to left, not left to right. And so I'm like, maybe I'll just stick with what I'm used to. So I'm starting to learn Greek. However, I have like a first grade reading level of Greek, which isn't that great. But It is really fun to study the Bible. It doesn't make me more spiritual. It doesn't make me extra or anything like that. It just makes reading and studying the Bible a little bit more interesting when I dig into it a little further. And I dug into this word transfiguration. And the word actually, I'm going to read it in Greek, is metamorphose. Metamorphose, right? He was transfigured. Now, for those of you on Facebook, can you guess what English word we get from metamorphose, right? Can you guess? First person to guess on Facebook during the 8 o'clock hour gets a high five from me later on. Time's up. Metamorphosis. You're right, right? It's cool to see like these Greek words that we kind of get the English equivalent for. But metamorphosis means a transformation, a transfiguration, something from the inside out. How do we know that it's from the inside out? Because they could have used a different word if they wanted to say that his figure changed, right? They could have used the word metaschematizo, metaschematizo, right? And that means like a change in appearance, but not necessarily from the inside out. But Jesus was emanating this light, not a light reflecting off of him. Like it wasn't a light coming from outside going toward him and it's like, oh, he was so bright because the light shone on him. No, he was so bright because the light was coming from inside of him. He was transfigured. Kind of neat. And here's what they saw after that. So like Jesus is changing before them. Like in Peter, James, and John, they aren't really sure what's going on. And to make matters a little bit more confusing, they then see two guys with him. In verse 4, it says, "And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus." Why these two? First of all, these two are supposedly have been dead for hundreds and hundreds of years. Yet here they are talking with their buddy Jesus, their rabbi, their teacher. Like this is like mind-blown, scary, but what is going on? What does this mean? Okay, well, first of all, Jesus is showing them their glory because of 6 days ago, they kind of dropped a bomb. Like, hey, following me looks a lot different than it did a week ago when you thought that I was gonna ride into Jerusalem and take over Rome and be that conquering king. Following me looks a little different. Are you still with me? Do you still trust me? And so Peter and John and James, they're looking at this scene and they're like, whoa, he is who he thought he was. This is good. This is reassuring for us. And they were terrified. And we know they're scared because in verse 5, Peter just starts, you know, talking off his head. He says, Peter said to Jesus in verse 5, "Rabbi, it's good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. I think I've been there. I think you've probably been there where you're kind of like, I don't know what to say, so I'm going to say this, and it maybe is the wrong thing to say. This was the wrong thing for Peter to say right here. He doesn't really understand it, but he was elevating Elijah and Moses to Jesus's level. But that's not why Moses and Elijah were there. Moses and Elijah were there as representations of the Old Testament law and the prophets. Moses representing the law, the one that gave the law. People want to follow the law. Moses is the man. Elijah, one of the prophets that is renowned, is who spoke truth unashamedly and boldly. And he representing this prophets in all of the prophecies. These two were here for the reason that Jesus has not come to destroy the laws and the prophets, but to fulfill. And so this moment on this mountain is a big deal to show that Jesus is now fulfilling these things. What he's about to do, the rest of the book, is fulfilling the laws and the prophets. Really a cool thing. But Peter, he doesn't really know what to say. So he kind of blurts out this thing, and it's like elevating those two guys to Jesus level, and God is gonna squash that right now. Here's in verse 7, he says, this is what God does. He says, "Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud saying, 'This is my son whom I love, listen to him.' Then suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus." They just got all the confirmation they needed. They just heard the voice of God. through this famous pillar of clouds, right? Maybe this is the same cloud that led the Israelites by day. Maybe this is the same cloud that came down and gave Daniel his vision. But this cloud comes down and surrounds Peter, John, and James and gives them the voice of the Lord saying, "This is my son, listen to him." And this is a big deal because this mountaintop experience has stayed with them for a long time. And they probably can't wait to go and share that with everyone they know. But in verse 9, it says, "As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead." Again, with the don't tell anyone business, right? What is all this down low, okay? Well, as I was reading a lot in Mark this week, I realized that Jesus does this a lot. He would silence people. He would silence demons from speaking out who he was. He would ask people after he healed them not to say anything. And he would kind of do this often. And even now he's telling his inner circle, "Hey, don't tell anyone what happened." And it's kind of perplexing. It's like, Jesus, don't you want to be known? Aren't we asked to make your name known? But there's some reasons why Jesus asked these things or silenced the demons. First of all, when you see that the demons would come, the demon-possessed people would come to Jesus, and the demons would automatically start crying out who Jesus was. They've known him since the beginning. They were created by him. And he started crying out, "Whoa, hail Jesus, the King, the glorious Lord. Like, what the heck is he doing here? Oh no." And Jesus silences them and then casts them out. Well, that makes sense because you don't really want a demon as a character reference for who you are. "Hey, did you hear about what the demon said this guy was? He said he was like the Lord." And the other guy might say, like, "Are you gonna believe what a demon says?" So he didn't want demons to be the first character references. But what about the people who were healed from blindness, from being lame, from deafness? Well, Jesus actually tried to keep that on the down low so that people wouldn't follow him for the wrong reasons. And as we see, people are starting to follow him for the wrong reason. So even though he tries to keep it quiet because it's not the right timing, he still is gathering people to him because they want to be healed. They want to be fed. They think, "Hey, if this was our leader, what could possibly go wrong?" Nothing. But those aren't the right reasons that Jesus wants to follow him. So verse 10, it says, "They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant." This was a big deal in these guys' lives. They kept this moment, like I said, for a long time. This was a mountaintop experience that stayed with these men for the rest of their lives. And how do we know this? Well, in 2 Peter 1, Peter is writing to the early church who are now being persecuted and suffering for their faith. And some of them are actually starting to think like, "Okay, is this really worth it? Like, our families being dragged out of our homes and being arrested and persecuted, is this worth it? I mean, has anyone ever met Jesus here? We just are taking their word for it, right?" But Peter tries to calm them down in 2 Peter 1 when he tells them, "Hey, I'm an eyewitness and you can trust my word." He says in 2 Peter 1, excuse me. "For we do not follow cleverly devised tales when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord, Jesus Christ. But we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. For when he received honor and glory from God the Father, such an utterance as this was made to him by the majestic glory, 'This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased.' And we ourselves heard this utterance made from heaven, and we were with him on the holy mountain." This mountaintop experience stayed with Peter so much that he uses it to fuel why he does what he does. And he uses this moment in life to tell others about Jesus and that he's worth following. This mountaintop experience probably gave James the moxie to stand up to the persecutors and become the first martyr. This mountaintop experience probably steeled John's nerves as he was going through persecution and survived persecution in order to live to an old age where he was abandoned to Patmos, and we get the books of 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, the Gospel of John, Revelation, right? It was this moment that they take with them as that was the time where I knew that Jesus was legit. What moments can you fall back on, saying those were the moments in my life where I knew this is it, I'm all in? Share that with somebody this week. Because Jesus said, hey, don't say anything until after I rise from the dead. Well, spoiler alert, Jesus has risen from the dead. We are now able to proclaim unashamedly the good news of the gospel because it is the power of God for salvation. This is what we live for, people. We live not only to glorify God, but to tell others about the relationship that is available to them, to tell others about the healings we have had through our soul, our hearts being restored through Jesus Christ, our forgiveness of sins. The time of proclamation is now. Tell someone about your mountaintop experience. But our story doesn't end there. After they are walking down the mountain, we'll go to verse 10 and 11 again. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. And they asked him, why do teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? And Jesus replied, to be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. And then it is written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected. But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they have done to him everything they wished, just as it is written about him. I think we get a short glimpse into a relationship with Jesus right here. Because we read through the Gospels, we only get snippets of what went on. And in fact, in the Gospel of John, it says, if we were to tell you everything that Jesus did, there aren't enough room in the libraries. But I wonder if this is what the conversations are when they're walking along from town to town, where they have an opportunity to ask Jesus questions. And as a rabbi, as a teacher, Jesus has an opportunity to answer them and dialogue with them and speculate. But what I love about this moment isn't necessarily the fact that, you know, they're talking about the prophecies and kind of helping us out, and we read the Old Testament, Malachi chapter 4. Hey, Elijah has to come first before the great day of the Lord. What does that mean? And then we get a little glimpse into here of like, okay, maybe John the Baptist had the power in the ministry of Elijah. So that's what Jesus meant when he said that he has come first. Or should we really dig deeper and be like, okay, well, what about the pre-tribulation dispensational theories of Revelation 11 and the two witnesses on the... No, we're not getting there, okay? Like, that's not what we can take away from this. What we can see, though, is that after their mountaintop experiences, these disciples were not afraid to ask questions. Why are we so afraid to ask questions? Are we worried that asking questions is a form of, like, I don't believe? Maybe. Are you worried that asking questions, you might get an answer you don't want to hear, so you stuff it? But here's the problem. In our Christian walk, we are encouraged to ask questions. Because if you don't ask a question, you're just gonna stuff it. And then you're gonna stuff another one and stuff another one. And all of a sudden, you've stuffed so many questions that have gone unanswered that you didn't even pursue, that when suffering comes, when trials come, you unload all these questions and say, this is the last straw. I don't even wanna follow Jesus anymore because he never answered any of my questions. But did you even ask the questions? Jesus is not afraid of our questions. Like, these guys are asking deep, dark, hard questions about prophecies and unknowns, but they're asking in light of, hey, how does this affect you? How does this affect me? How do we live our life knowing what these things are? Like they're asking questions so that they can grow. Ask questions. Email Matt at believersfellowship.net. Email Jeremiah, right? Ask them good questions because they've got wise answers. They've lived life, they've studied the word, and they want to walk with you. So they're coming down the mountain. Let's carry on. Verse 14, they came back down the mountain, and when they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. Let's stop right there. They came down off the mountain. They see the other disciples. The gang's all back together again. But then they see the teachers of the law arguing, the religious leaders of the day arguing with the disciples. And they're kind of wondering, like, what's going on? Like, what the heck? So they're arguing with their followers. And there seems to be a dispute. But verse 15, as soon as the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. As soon as they saw Jesus, they ran to greet him. Maybe Jesus still had that glow from the night before, similar to what Moses had when he came down after meeting with God on the mountain. His face glowed. They actually had him cover his face because it was freaking people out. Hey, Moses, cover your face. But I wonder if Jesus had a little afterglow as he came down the mountain and people saw him and they're like, that's the guy. That's clearly the guy we've heard about. Let's go talk to him. And Jesus is wondering what they're arguing about, because it's clear if you could walk into a group of people and it's clear that people are arguing, even from a distance, they had to run to greet him, right? You know that the argument is heated. And Jesus probably came at the right moment because some of the disciples were a little hot-headed and they probably would get in a little bar fight here. But verse 16, Jesus asks them, what are you arguing with them about? And then a man in the crowd answered, teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they couldn't. So here we see the reason for the argument. We've got a demon-possessed child or lad or boy, and they asked the disciples to heal him, and the disciples couldn't do it. And so now we've got the religious leaders starting to, you know, jab and jeer. It's like, oh, what happens now? Like, you used to be able to cast out demons. How come you can't do this one? Is Jesus your teacher really all that he says he is if he doesn't give you that power and skill? That could be a reason of the argument. And the disciples are getting heated. They're like, what'd they say about Jesus? Hold me back, right? But if we remember, we learned way before COVID, and you probably don't remember anything before COVID. But I don't have another recap for you. I'll just tell you. Matt and Jeremiah, they talked about the traditional views of exorcism way back even in Mark 1, right? Or Mark 2. Like, there was first century Judaism exorcism. The key to success was, remember what it was? What's the key to success if you want to exorcise a demon from someone? Naming them. Yeah, that's right. That's right. If you typed it in first, I'll give you a shout out next week on the Facebook. But remember, naming the demon is the key to success according to rabbinic tradition. And since this particular demon made the boy mute, robbed him of his speech, they couldn't name him. And so they didn't have the power over him. At least that's their theory. Jesus has a different theory later on. We'll get to, don't read ahead. So theirs were set up. The people were arguing that this little boy couldn't be healed by the disciples. And Jesus has an answer for them in verse 19. He says, you unbelieving generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me. So they brought him. And when the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground, rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Again, the demon recognizes who Jesus is and realizes his time is short. And in a really terrifying moment, it tries to do as much damage as possible before being cast out. In verse 21, Jesus asks the boy's father, how long has he been like this? From childhood, he answered. It has often thrown him into the fire or water to kill him. Notice how Jesus is so tender. Like, he's spitting venom at the scribes and Pharisees, the unbelieving generation. And then he turns to the dad, whose son has now been made an argument, a political argument, no less. He turns to the son, and turns to the dad and says, in great bedside manner, how long has he been like this? Tell me about him. Like, how tender is that moment for that dad? Verse 22. It has often thrown him into the fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. If you can, said Jesus, everything is possible for one who believes. I don't want to read Jesus into Jesus's tone too much. Like, if, you know, if you can? Like maybe someone might read it as like, if you can. Did you say if? I'm Jesus. Hello. I don't read it like that. I think Jesus might even give him a little wink here because it's such a tender moment. You know, the bedside manner doesn't turn into like doubt and dispute so quickly. I want to believe that Jesus maybe gives a little wink like, if you can, it's all possible if you believe. And then immediately, the boy's father exclaimed, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. This dad has had such an up and down day. Like, I've been trying to practice empathy more. I want to try to put myself in other people's shoes so that I can try to understand how they feel and how I might make them feel. And if I were to try to practice empathy with this dad, think about this. He hears about Jesus, even though people are not supposed to tell you anything about Jesus, he still hears about him. And he took the time to travel to find him. Maybe it was a day's travel. We don't know how long he traveled, but if it's anything like Gig Harbor, it's 15 minutes by car to get anywhere, but they were walking, so it's probably further, right? So he probably had to pack a lunch. He probably had to coax his boy, who is demon-possessed, and he doesn't know when he's going to go off the handle, and walk to find Jesus. And he's probably full of hope. So all day long, he's traveling full of hope. And when he gets to where Jesus is supposed to be, everybody's like, hey, have you seen Jesus? He's pointing that way. Hey, have you seen Jesus pointing that way? So he's finally following the trail and finds where Jesus is, only to find that there's no Jesus available. Oh, where's Jesus? Oh, he's up on the mountain on a weekend retreat. What? I traveled all this way. I've got my son here. What can we do? And then the disciples are like, oh, we know Jesus. We can probably take care of this. We've cast out demons before. So the hope is full, the hope is down, the disciples are there, the hope is up again, but now the disciples can't do it, and now the hope is down again, and now people are even using his son as a key piece to an argument between the disciples and scribes. It's obviously not what he expected, but he does believe. But he's just wondering, is it too good to be true? Is what I've heard too good to be true? And maybe you've been there. Maybe you have taken steps to believe in Jesus. You've tasted and seen that the Lord is good, and you follow him with your whole heart. And you've had those mountaintop experiences where you've turned away from your sin, repented from your sin, and fully turned toward Jesus. But when you come down to the valley, you wonder, is it too good to be true? Because you fall into temptation. You fall into the enemy's attacks, who's roaring around like a prowling lion ready to devour you. Because you start coasting and you stop your studies. You stop praying. The distraction-free environment you had is now full of distractions. Have you been, I believe, help my unbelief. Have you been there? You're not alone. But what happens when we go through those trials? What do we need to be focusing on? Well, James 1 says, whenever you encounter various trials, consider it pure joy, because you can let it take endurance and create perseverance in your walk with God. You're looking ahead to what God is going to do, even in the midst of heartbreak. Think about it. Hebrews 11 is full of a cloud of witnesses, who people who have suffered and persecuted and died, yet they still put their faith in something coming ahead. And now Jesus is asking us to follow him and put our trust in him, and you will have various trials in this world. But this is not the end. There's something we look forward to. When Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the impure spirit. You deaf and mute spirit, he said, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. Quick note, notice when the crowd started to come, he healed the boy as quick as he could. Keep it on the DL. Verse 26, the spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. And the boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. In just a few moments, we're going to celebrate communion. And every week when we do this, it is a reminder for us. And we need reminders, don't we? We need reminders of who God is. Is he still worth following? The mountaintop experience. We need reminders of what he can do in our lives. And guess what? We are in great company because the disciples, they needed reminders. They needed to keep Jesus in the forefront of their minds. Otherwise, they'll forget what to do. They'll forget that the mountaintop experience is just one experience that can catapult us forward the rest of our lives. But if we start letting the questions pile up, if we start letting the distractions come in and the arguments and debates come in, we might forget what our relationship with God looks like. And the story ends in verse 28 and 29. It says, after Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, and they wanted to know something. Why couldn't we drive it out? Why couldn't we drive out this impure spirit from this boy? What was it that we couldn't do it? And he replied, this kind can only come out by prayer. What? So you're telling me that the disciples didn't pray before they tried to do this miracle? Are you telling me that even the disciples forgot and they needed a reminder? We forget too. We forget that we follow a God who isn't afraid of our questions, who wants us to have those experiences with him that we can hold on to the rest of our lives. But we forget that when we let the distraction and debates come in, we forget to pray even. So let this body and cup, bread and cup, be a reminder to us what a relationship with him could look like. What are your mountaintop experiences? What are the questions that you have? What are the doubts that you have? Can you go to God with those? Even now, as we take this meal together. Hopefully you have your elements at home. And as we do every week, at home even, will you stand with me as we read from 1 Corinthians? For I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, this is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And in the same way, he took the cup after supper, saying, this is the cup of the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Let's pray. Father, let this reminder be for us right now, that we remember that you died and you rose again. And this is the hope that we have, not only in heaven, but also the hope now that you can heal our aching hearts, that you can restore our broken relationships, that you can forgive us of our sins. And Lord, when we have questions, will you give us clear answers? Bring people into our lives Give us wisdom in your word. Give us a trust that you are good and that you love us. Father, thank you for this morning. Thank you for your word. And thank you for these reminders. In your son's name, amen.